Support for Studio 360's podcast is provided by The Economist, committed to writing about issues that matter and the connections between them. The Economist, see the world differently at newsstands and economist.com.
Today in Studio 360, writers and artists tackling the big issues, love, death, Martians.
You say we are violent and barbaric, but has any one of you come up to my cage and extended his hand? Because if he did, I would jerk it off and eat it right in front of him.
Jack Handy has some tough words for our enemies two planets away.
That's good Martian, I would say.
And we'll hear an Emily Dickinson poem that may haunt you till the day you die, or afterward.
Because I could not stop for death.
He kindly stopped for me.
The carotel, but just ourselves.
And immortality.
Plus, murder and race relations in a quiet university town, in a novel by Stephen Carter. That and more is all ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today, the novelist Stephen Carter will tell us about elite African-American secret societies, and we'll also meet a 70s soul singer who wasn't just forgotten. He completely disappeared. But first, one of the most moving and also unsentimental movies I've seen in the last year was Julian Schnabel's The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. It's just out on DVD now. The film tells the true story of this glamorous, high-living French fashion magazine editor who became paralyzed suddenly by a stroke. But his mind remained completely functional. It's a nightmare known as locked-in syndrome. The man, Jean-Dominique Bauby, could only move his left eye, and he learned to communicate by blinking that eye.
Alors je commence.
E-S-A-R-I-N. A speech therapist would recite the alphabet, starting with A, and Bauby would blink when he heard the letter he wanted. He spelled out words and sentences, letter by letter.
E-S-A-R-I-N-T-U-L-O-M-D-P-C-C. Merci.
And that's how Bauby wrote his entire memoir. I asked Julian Schnabel about the title of his film, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
At first, he describes himself stuck in this diving bell, which is a suit that you put on to walk on the bottom of the ocean, with weights on your feet and a big helmet that is bolted to your torso, and it's extremely claustrophobic. But once he decides he needs to get out of there, the only way he can do that is with his imagination and his memory. And I think once you don't have anything else except your brain to use, you start using it.
And we hear him in the film doing this voiceover. He barely utters sounds throughout the whole course of the movie, but he is witty and rueful and all the things that he was inside.
Well, he's very, very funny. I mean, these beautiful women are talking to him all the time. They're all trying to help him in some way. No one knows what he's thinking. And the mother of his children comes to see him, but she always remains in the past for him. He's already trying to seduce the new writer who is going to assist him in this book, and he's fantasizing about her. And I love the idea that the guy doesn't even have to do anything, but he's cheating on his wife just because he's thinking.
And blinking. And he kind of succeeds in seducing her, I mean, as much as he can.
She fell in love with him. It just happens to be a fact. You know, I met all of these characters, and she...
And filmed it at that hospital.
I filmed it in the hospital where it took place, and the first person you see in the movie is his nurse. And there are many other people that actually worked in the hospital. It was very important for me because the hospital is an extraordinarily beautiful place. It looks like an Antonioni set. It also is right on the coast, and the tide goes in and out 500 meters every day. So sometimes you would look like you're on the moon out there, and I think that this man was on the far edge of life. So just visually, the opportunities. There was a stanchion that was on the beach, and when the tide would come in, it was buried. So I thought, okay, I'll take his wheelchair and stick him in the middle of the ocean, which we did.
And the actor who plays Jean Doe, as he's called, is presumably a fully able-bodied human being?
Absolutely. He can break dance.
But he doesn't, literally doesn't move. In the course of most of this film, we see some flashbacks where he's healthy.
Most of the time, I mean, the interesting thing about it is that if you stay still that long, it has an effect on you. And I think that he was betting on that and getting into that. I mean, I could never do that. He had a patch over one eye. He had a prosthetic denture holding his mouth in a contorted position, plus his lip was glued to his face. And he had something stuck in his nose and a contact lens over another eye. I could never have been in that situation for more than a few minutes. This man is extremely, he's very tough. He actually went in the diving bell also. And there was no radio in there. You could just hear.
There are scenes of him in a diving bell at the
under
bottom
the
of the water.
Yes.
Why do you think you responded so strongly to this story when it crossed your path?
Well, it crossed my path a long time ago, and I resisted making this movie. I used to read to my friend Fred Hughes, who managed the factory for Andy Warhol. He had MS, and he was stuck inside of his body. And I'd go up to Lexington Avenue to his house and read to him, and his nurse, Darren McCormick, handed me a book called The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. I didn't even read it at first. Years went by, and Fred died, and then my father got sick, and he had prostate cancer.
And he was very old.
He was 92, but he'd never been sick in his life. And he was very young inside of his body, but he was stuck in there. He was stuck inside of his body.
You've said that you actually intend for this film to be useful, to help people deal with the prospect of death.
Yes.
It's a tall order.
Yeah, it really is, because I've been terrified of death my whole life.
Unlike most people, I guess, yeah.
Well, some people don't have a problem with it. My father did. My mother didn't. My mother had congestive heart failure, and she died many times and came back. She didn't think it was any big deal. My father had never been sick. But, you know, Tarkovsky wrote...
The film director.
Yes. He wrote a book called Sculpting in Time. And he wrote that life contains death. Art, unlike life, doesn't contain death, so it denies death. That means it's life-affirming. Jean-Dominique Bauby was not a great artist before his accident, but because he was reporting back from this vantage point in this place in between life and death, he was able to tell people how to live.
This horrible condition becomes his path to wisdom and maybe even art creation.
Absolutely. It made him a great artist.
When you started directing films, you had been an important painter at that point for 15 years. Was it hard to start something entirely new at 45?
Was I 45?
Yeah.
What, 1995?
44?
Yeah. I never thought I was going to be a movie director. I love movies. I've always been a movie fan. I used to go to the Elgin Theater and sit there, watch 3-4 movies a day when I was broke. You could just sort of get out of the rain in there. And I have been a painter since I was a child. And I am a painter. That's what I do.
And you still paint?
Sure. Of course I do. I mean, that's my day job. But someone wanted to make a film about Jean-Michel Basquiat.
Which became your first film.
Yeah, and he came to interview me, and I tried to help him. I had no intention of directing that movie, but it was going to be a tourist that was going to make that film, and I couldn't let that happen.
A tourist?
He was a tourist.
Somebody who didn't know this world that you knew.
Exactly. So I made a movie about something I knew about.
Can I help you?
You want to buy some ignorant art?
10 bucks a piece? Gee, ignorant art, Bruno.
Yeah, you know, like, stupid, like, ridiculous, crummy art.
Wow. That sounds good. That's new.
$10.
Oh, gee, didn't work very much on these. I can give you, like, 5.
If God said to you tomorrow, you can either paint or make films, what do you choose?
I'd ask him who gave him the right to ask me that question.
And playing God, I will say, I'm God, Julian. You can do one. Which would you rather?
I would paint. You can paint by yourself. The fact, you know, it's sort of a trick question, God, because without the freedom that I have because I'm a painter, I never could have done this. I mean, I literally financed the, even though 2 other guys put up some of the money for the first film, I guaranteed those with paintings. I mean, the thing about painting is you don't have to know if it's good or bad while you're doing it. You're in the throes of this thing. And when you ask me, you know, if I had to decide, what would I do? What I thought of was, I paint outside, and most of the time. And so to me, summer is synonymous with life. And painting is synonymous with summer. And there was this painting I was thinking about that had this kind of big image of a guy surfing on it with some white paint. And I thought of this little skein of white that just went to the tip. And I remember sitting on the floor of the studio and looking at that bit of white. There was gesso all over my hands, and there was this white mark. I didn't know what the hell it meant. But I remember it fondly because I thought, I got about 30 summers left. And then I thought, you know, if I go somewhere warm, I got another 30. So now if I take 2 vacations every year, I could have 90 summers. That means I could live another 90 years. Because basically when I'm painting, it's sort of a...
It's like cat years, dog years, artist years, I guess.
Yeah, that's good. No, it's really a justification of the ordinariness of my life. It's total freedom.
Julian Schnabel, thank you very much for coming into Studio 360 today.
You're welcome.
Julian Schnabel's film, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, is out right now on DVD. Coming up, we hear what happens when a performer falls out of the spotlight. Way, way out of the spotlight.
My son called me up on the line. Say, Pop, somebody trying to find you if you're living or if you're dead.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
When people fall in love, they cry.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Justin Torres is a DJ and a full-bore record nut, the kind of guy who spends his time in record stores and flea markets combing through stacks of dusty old LPs, looking for obscure gems. He spent years trying to track down a certain singer named Darren Pulliam, who had put out a bunch of singles in the early 1970s under the name Duranda.
I believe every man should have.
Durando was fairly hot in the Bay Area, briefly. He once opened for James Brown. But by the time Justin Torres went looking for him decades later, Durando had gone missing.
You know, Durando was always a mystery to a lot of people. He only put out 3 45s, but the one that really made a big impact on a lot of people was his Music City release called Didn't I? And it's just a really fantastic song that caught the eyes and ears of from here to Japan. Everybody likes it. It has always been in demand. The first time I got Didn't I was out of this man's garage. You know, as a record collector, sometimes the record stores aren't good enough. You know, the thrift stores and the flea markets aren't good enough. You gotta go door to door trying to find people who still have those old records. There's a black motorcycle club out in San Francisco on 3rd Street. And there's this guy named Big John, real buff guy. And he let me go through a bunch of his old records, and Durando was the first time I'd ever seen it. By the time I got it home and put on Didn't I fell in love.
Didn't I treat you right?
So to track him down, that was one of my goals for 2 years. A lot of people have tried and just come up short. Josh Davis, DJ Shadow, had tried. He was telling me stories like, I tried to find him and made phone calls and asked around, and he seems to be like off the face of the earth. And I had given up. You know, I'd asked all I could. It was just a dead end for me. 2 days later, I'm sitting just about to eat some lunch, and I get a phone call from a blocked number. And he was like,
I was full of fire, I was a world of light. I was a woman's dream both day and night. I was swift and fast, and I was always on the go. Most folks call me Rolls Royce Dorado. I'm going to tell you, the first time that I knew somebody was looking for me was about 8 years ago. And I put the number in my pocket, you know what I'm talking about, and I didn't really too much after that, I didn't think about the number. And then my son called me up on the line and said, hey, Pops. I said, yeah. He said, you know, I got a number here on the internet that somebody trying to find you if you're living or if you're dead.
The story that really attracted us was the fact that a lot of people were saying that he used to be a pimp. So you get these images of Fillmore Slim and you think, wow, pimp making these love songs? Like, what are you talking about?
It's been a lot of myth. Because, see, back in them days, you know, I was very fast. But I wasn't that fast. You know, the cars, you know, they driving a lot of Cadillacs and this and that. And, you know, Mercedes-Benz. I was driving the Rolls Royce. It was a 1965 Silver Cloud with the Bradley conversion kit in it. So you went somewhere and you wanted to eat, you could park and open up the trunk and pull the thing in the back out, and it folded out into a picnic table, like a dining table. And it even had a little electric stove where if you wanted, like you wanted some tea, you wanted to cook, you know, while you're riding, it had that in it. That was in it. Scanners, all that was in it. Then it just had all them kind of little gadgets in it. Said
you better let my... You know, the thing about him is he loves music. And this was a man who everybody was like, man, you can't sing. Come on, get in yourself. And when you tell Durando he can't do something, you know, you messed up because he ends up doing it right.
So I sit down and wrote that song, How I Got Over and Want Your Love So Bad. Because like I said, I wanted to just put a record out. Got cast away, I took it down. They said, boy, I like this here. So one morning, like about a week or two had passed, and I'm driving down the street in my car, and then I hear this record come on. And I said, oh, and he's playing this record, you know. So right there, you know, like I said, and at the time, it was, to me, it was just like a hobby, because it was just something that I wanted to do, and I wanted to see if I could do it.
Really, man, they're legends. They're just legendary records. He has that track Legs on his Alpha World label. And it's just this hard-hitting funk track about females. Legs! Look good to me in the morning. Legs! Look good to me at night. Legs! Make me want to hold you and love you. Legs! To show the
see, that leg meant, give me some stuff. That's what the leg meant. Baby, give me some leg. That meant I want to get down. Back then, they'd have to play it underground. You know, they'd have, you know, speakeasies. Every one you go to, you would hear leg. Five young girls walking down the street.
Leg looks so good, make you want to say please. My wife fell in love with the music. She's heard it all, trust me. I mean, I sell records for a living. You know, I have well over 20,000 records. So for someone who's never really into that kind of sound, to pick up something and be able to, you know, snap your fingers and really get into the tune, that's what it's going to be for people. There's some real amazing musicians out there. So giving these cats a chance again, maybe it won't work for them. But some of them it will. And I think Durando's that cat that's going to make everybody be like, damn, I was missing out. Walking in and shaking the thing. She looks so good to me now. I want your love so bad, baby.
Justin Torres has compiled a record of Durando songs called Let My People Go. And Durando is performing live in California later this month. You can find out details about that at studio360.org. Our story was produced by Chris Roos. Some song or movie or building or book altered the course of your life somehow, let us know about it. Drop us a line at studio360.org.
When people fall in love.
Stephen Carter is a law professor at Yale and a well-known commentator on religion and race and politics. So it was a little surprising a few years ago when he wrote and published a murder mystery, The Emperor of Ocean Park. The book went on to become a bestseller. His second novel, New England White, is also a mystery. It concerns a prominent black family living in a picture-perfect, nearly all-white enclave near an Ivy League university, and New England White is just out in paperback. Stephen Carter, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks very much. I'm pleased to be here.
Your two novels are similar. What do you think draws you to the murder mystery as a form?
I enjoy writing things with twists and turns in them, and I think I have a theory about why. You might notice that lots of lawyers, when they turn to fiction, write mysteries or thrillers or some combination of the two.
The Scott Turows and Grishams of the world.
For example, exactly. And I think one reason is that from the very first day of law school, young lawyers in waiting are trained to constantly think of what if this happened, what if this happened. There's contingencies all day long. And what is a thriller really than a series of what if this happens, except the author makes them actually happen. So I think that actually writing a thriller in the sense of a book with a lot of twists and turns fits very well with the way that lawyers are trained.
Although most lawyers, in my experience, aren't very felicitous writers. You have that going for you as well.
I've always loved writing. From the time I was a very small boy, I can remember not long after I learned to write, going down to the Five and Dime. Now I'm aging myself, but that's what it was. Going down to the Five and Dime near my house and buying these little notebooks, really little. They're 3 or 4 inches high and maybe 20 pages thick. And I would just fill them with stories or whatever came into my head. I've always loved putting words on paper. And I've written a lot of nonfiction books. I've written scholarly articles. But the truth is my first love was fiction, because back when I was a little boy, fictional stories, that was what I wrote. And I'm just glad to be able to get back to it.
Was there a moment when you read a work of fiction that you thought, God, I really want to do this someday?
You know, when I was in 10th grade, I had a wonderful English teacher. Her name was Judith Dickey, and she made a deal with me because at that time, I admit, I loved reading, but I would read science fiction and detective comic books and things like that. That was my reading. And Mrs. Dickey sat me down, and she said, you know, Stephen, you're a pretty smart kid, but you should be reading better stuff. And I was resistant, so she made a deal with me. She would read any book I gave her if I would read any book she gave me. And we read several books together that way, and that really made me excited about serious fiction. And I remember a couple of them, The Count of Monte Cristo or something like that, I'm not sure, The Ugly American, I remember that one very distinctly, and one of them I think was a separate piece. More than any particular book, I think that experience of reading books beyond the kind of stuff I'd consumed before got me really excited about both reading and writing. I'd always wanted to write, but now I really wanted to write well.
So explain to the listeners where the title New England White comes from. What does that mean?
The title, I suppose, has meanings on a lot of different levels. I set my thriller in a New England town in the winter, and so, of course, there's plenty of snow. It's also true that my main character, Julia Carlisle, is a black woman who lives with her family in an all-white little village next to the college town, another layer of whiteness. But I also have in mind something of mystery, that is, of what lies beneath. I've always thought that college campuses are inherently scary places. You think of all those Gothic towers and the lights out at night and people hurrying from place to place with their heads down and their collars drawn. And I also try to get across the title, New England White, some notion of what lies beneath, that beneath the evident purity of the surface, there's something else broiling and bubbling down there.
So the family lives in a mansion in this
big house
in the Landing. Give us a sense of what the larger town of Elm Harbor is like.
Well, Elm Harbor is a college town with significant town-gown tensions. There are a lot of minority residents, a lot of poor people in the town, as there are in a growing number of college towns. You have a faculty that's largely moved to the suburbs, as you also have in a growing number of college towns. But it's still a town and a county with its traditions. And although I tell people it's not modeled on New Haven, they refuse to believe it. But nevertheless, it's a figment of my imagination.
Well, and you say it in an author's note at the end that it's not a thinly disguised version of New Haven. When I read that, I thought, no, it's not. It's just New Haven. It's not thinly disguised at all.
Well, it may have some commonalities. I say in the author's note that the two towns share some of the same ghosts, and I think I'll stick with that.
One of the reasons that people regard this novel, like your first one, as more than just a thriller or just a mystery is that race is so front and center. Did you have a big idea about black people in America that you were trying to get across?
One of the things I've tried to emphasize in my fiction is the way that well-to-do black Americans over time, even over the centuries, have built a kind of secret world that very few white Americans know much about, and actually not that many black Americans know much about it either. A secret world of clubs and fraternities and sororities, a secret world of vacation spots, secret world of networks and connections that I think most people know little about.
How do your fellow members of that elite black society feel about your giving all of us white people glimpses into it?
Well, you know, I want to emphasize that although the characters in my novel, many of them grew up in well-to-do black families, some of them having money for generations, I didn't grow up that way. But I certainly know a lot of people who did. And the people I know, they tend to look on this kind of fiction quite favorably. I don't think that the secret world of black privilege is secret because people are trying to keep it hidden. It's secret because they don't go around bragging about it. It's just something that they do very naturally, not something that from which they've concocted some great mystery. Now, if I can make that world a little more mysterious in my fiction, I'm happy to do so. But it's fiction. But I will say this: I find that one of the themes of this novel, something that's repeated by several of the black characters over and over again, is that it doesn't make a difference to the fate of black people who's in the White House. And I have heard, not from people on the right, people on the left actually are quite upset about my saying that. But I try to point out, number one, it's a novel, it's a point of view, but I do think there's an awful lot of black people who feel that way. There's an awful lot of black people who, even though they tend to vote Democratic, think really, especially for the worst off black people, it doesn't make much difference who's in the White House, and the data tend to bear that out.
We have potentially a black person who's going to be president. Does that prospect cheer you, or is it irrelevant to you?
Of course, as a black man, I would be excited by a black man succeeding in politics, a black man or woman, or anywhere else. I was raised to cheer on the race in that sense, and I still do. But I really believe that whoever is elected president, a lot of the trends that we've seen in the African-American community, especially among the worst off, there are things government can do to alleviate those things and things government should do, but there's a lot of things the community has to do as well. A lot of it involves not the establishment of programs, but the rolling up of sleeves. And that's a really hard thing to get people to do nowadays. And that may be one reason that we see all these depressing data, that no matter who's president, the trends for the worst off people in the black community tend to continue in the same direction. They may be a little less, a little more, a little faster, a little slower, but the trends are still what they are. And we all know the alarming statistics, and they're still pretty alarming.
Do you have a sense, as a writer of novels, that this work can have an actual impact?
Well, certainly my novels are first and foremost intended to entertain. But beyond that, I'm not trying to transmit big ideas, but I'm trying to tweak people a little bit. I'm less trying to persuade people on either side of various issues than to try to make them sit up and think a little bit about questions that might arise.
Stephen Carter, thank you very much for joining me today in Studio 360.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Stephen Carter's new novel is called New England White, and there is more about it and about him at studio360.org. And from the real-world complexities of race relations, we'll move to the problem of interplanetary species relations. Jack Handy, the creator of Saturday Night Live's Deep Thoughts, has a new book called What I'd Say to the Martians. And he joins us now to read his title story from that collection. One word of caution, Jack Handy's speech is meant for our enemies, but maybe not for very young listeners.
My Speech to the Martians by Jack Handy. People of Mars, you say we are brutes and savages. But let me tell you one thing. If I could get loose from this cage you have me in, I would tear you guys a new Martian asshole. You say we are violent and barbaric. But has any one of you come up to my cage and extended his hand? Because if he did, I would jerk it off and eat it right in front of him. That's good Martian, I would say. You say your civilization is more advanced than ours. But who is really the more civilized one? You, standing there watching this cage? Or me, with my pants down, trying to urinate on you? You criticize our Earth religions, saying they have no relevance to the way we actually live. But think about this. If I could get my hands on that god of yours, I would grab his skinny neck and choke him until his big green head exploded. We are a warlike species, you claim, and you show me films of Earth battles to prove it. But I have seen all the films about 20 times. Get me some new films, or so help me, if I ever get out of here, I will empty my laser pistol on everyone I see, even pets. You point to your long tradition of living peacefully with Earth, but you know what I point to? Your stupid heads. You say there is much your civilization could teach ours, but perhaps there is something that I could teach you, namely, how to scream like a parrot when I put your big Martian head in a vise. You claim there are other intelligent beings in the galaxy besides Earthlings and Martians. Good, then we can attack them together. And after we're through attacking them, we'll attack you. I came here in peace, seeking gold and slaves. But you have treated me like an intruder. But maybe it is not me who is the intruder, but you. No, not me, you, stupid. You may kill me, either on purpose or by not making sure that all the surfaces in my cage are safe to lick. But you can't kill an idea, and that idea is me chasing you with a big wooden mallet. You say you will release me only if I sign a statement saying I will not attack you, and I have agreed, the only condition being that I can sign with a long, sharp pen, and yet you still keep me locked up. True, you have allowed me reading material, not the human reproduction magazines I requested, but the works of your greatest philosopher, Sandor or Xanax or whatever his name is. I would like to discuss his ideas with him, just me, him, and one of his big heavy books. If you will not free me, at least deliver a message to Earth. Send my love to my wife and also to my girlfriend and to my children, if I have any place. Ask my wife to please send me a bazooka, which is a flower we have on Earth. If my so-called friend Don asks you where the money is I owe him, please anally probe him. Do that anyway. If you keep me in prison long enough, eventually I will die. Because one thing you Martians do not understand is, we humans cannot live without our freedom. So if you see me lying lifeless in my cage, come on in, because I'm dead. Really. Maybe one day we will not be the enemies you make us out to be. Perhaps one day a little Earth child will sit down to play with a little Martian child, or larva, or whatever they are. But after a while, guess what happens? The little Martian tries to eat the Earth child. But look what the Earth child has. A gun. You weren't expecting that, were you? And now the Martian child is running away as fast as he can, Run, Little Martian Baby, run. I would like to thank everyone for coming to my cage to hear my speech. Donations are gratefully accepted. No Mars money, please.
That's Jack Handy. His new book is called What I'd Say to the Martians and Other Veiled Threats. You can hear Jack Handy reading more of his stories at studio360.org. Coming up, why are poets like Billy Collins so excited by Emily Dickinson?
I've removed her tippet, of course, and then the gown of gossamer. That's got to go.
Is she naked at the end of this poem?
She's naked in the second stanza.
Sex and death, especially death, in American Lit. That's ahead at Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. This week was the anniversary of Emily Dickinson's death in 1886. While she was alive, Dickinson was unpublished and unknown by the wider world. After she died, her sister searched through her dresser and found nearly 2,000 poems. In a surprising number of those poems, Dickinson imagined herself already dead, as was the case with Because I Could Not Stop for Death. For a high school English standby, that poem is a very strange work of art. As part of our series on American icons, we asked Sean Cole, who's a poet himself, to take a closer look at it.
I started off by looking at the original. It's at the Houghton Library at Harvard University. One of the curators, Leslie Morris, had it waiting for me in the Dickinson room.
It's under lock and key.
The room is filled with stuff that actually belonged to Dickinson, stuff that was important to her.
She wrote at that table?
She wrote at that table and in that chair.
Oh, my God.
Emily Dickinson is a poetry prophet. You hear all the time that she was a modernist before modernism and a surrealist before surrealism. And yet, I never thought Because I Could Not Stop for Death was that great an example of what she could do. It seemed too high school-y, too obvious and archetypal. But seeing the thing she wrote with her hand, it was like looking at some sacred lost scroll.
Could you possibly read the poem?
Would you mind reading it?
Sure. No, I mean, no. Because I could...
All right, ready? Because I could not stop for death.
He kindly stopped for me.
The carotel, but just ourselves.
And immortality.
We slowly drove. He knew no haste.
And I had put away my labor and my leisure too.
For his civility.
We passed the school where children strove.
At recess in the ring.
We passed the fields of gazing grain.
We passed the setting sun.
Or rather, he passed us.
The dews drew quivering and chill.
For only gossamer my gown.
My tippet only tulle.
We paused before a house that seemed a swelling of the ground.
The roof was scarcely visible.
The cornice in the ground.
Since then, 'tis centuries.
And yet feel shorter than the day.
I first surmised the horse's heads.
Or toward eternity. Wonderful poem, isn't it?
It's perfect, really, that Dickinson should write from the perspective of someone who's already died. No one heard Dickinson's true voice until after her death, and she weirdly seems to have planned for posthumous fame. For example, when the poems were discovered in the Bureau, about 900 of them, including Because I Could Not Stop for Death, were neatly copied out into 40 hand-bound booklets. Leslie Morris let me hold the piece of string Dickinson used to bind one of them.
Oh, my God. Wow. I've never been so enthralled by holding a piece of string before.
I was so thrilled, I told my friend Joseph about it. Like, I'm, like, practically crying over a piece of dirty string
well,
that I'm holding
in my hand.
It
wasn't just any piece of dirty string.
It wasn't just any piece of dirty string. Joseph Leese, is chair of the MFA program in writing at California College of the Arts and a celebrated poet himself. He's the one who first turned me on to how radical Dickinson was for her time, which is why she's so much more popular now than a lot of other 19th century American poets, he says.
True.
You, if you ask Americans, you know, well, you've read some poetry in school. Who do you love? Americans don't say, oh, I love Longfellow. Boy, I mean, some of them do. Longfellow has his fans,
hither,
but...
Come hither, my little daughter, and do not tremble so, for I can weather the roughest gale that ever wind did blow.
Henry Wadsworth Longfellow was part of a whole windy gang known as the Fireside Poets. They wrote long, Midnight Ride of Paul Revere-type macho verse, poetry with a capital P. It was Dickinson's little p, her plain-spokenness and economy, that helped usher American poetry into its next era. She could worm through to the same huge issues, death, beauty, love, using a fraction of the words, in a meter so common.
It's called common meter, usually, yeah. It's da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
This is Billy Collins, former U.S. Poet Laureate.
Da-da-da-da-da-da. That 4-3 meter, it's the meter of the hymn, as everyone knows. It's also the meter of nursery rhymes. Old King Cole was a merry old soul, and a merry old soul was he. Same exact rhythm.
A rhythm that can sound kind of repetitive to younger readers of Dickinson these days.
I'm in this writing class right now, and one of the first days we got there, there was a group of people sitting in the corner just bashing her.
Jenny Proctor is a senior at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. When she was in high school, she started an Emily Dickinson fan club that no one joined. Now that she's in college, things haven't gotten much better.
They're like, you can sing her songs to the tune of...
Gilligan's Island.
Gilligan's Island. Thank you. You know, and they were singing along and laughing, and, you know, I didn't join in or anything.
Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me.
You know, I tried to stand up for her, and I'm just like, you know, hey, she did it beautifully. You know, I'd like to see you try that.
To achieve such linguistic originality within the little dance, the very conservative little structure of that meter is part of her wonderment.
There's a kind of, and this is a big theme in the Dickinson literature, the lack of reference in her language.
This is Robert Howard. He's studied the Dickinson literature at length and written articles on her work.
Take the example of gazing grain. What is gazing grain? I mean, you might think grazing grain, but, you know, it sounds absolutely right, but there's no way really to know what it means.
We passed the fields of gazing grain. We passed the setting sun.
The thing is, you don't have to know what it means. Dickinson understood, innately, that something could feel true without having to make literal sense. No one else was playing with words like that at the time. Walt Whitman was just as radical, but in a totally opposite, declarative, celebratory way. And in any case, Dickinson never read him, said she heard he was scandalous.
This is Emily Dickinson's bedroom.
It's Dickinson's house is about 3 blocks from the center of Amherst, Mass. It's a museum now. Cindy Dickinson showed me around. She's the director of programming and interpretation.
And I am not related to Emily Dickinson.
That's so funny.
A lot of people think of Dickinson as having been holed up in this house her whole life. But for about 15 years of it, she lived down the street.
The other house looked out over the town cemetery. And many scholars speculate that one reason she wrote using funerals, cemeteries as imagery is that that was her experience. I mean, it was right next door. So they were her neighbors, in essence. So that is...
The dead were her
the
neighbors.
The dead, yes, right.
And now she's buried in that cemetery.
Born December 10th, 1830. Called back May 15th, 1886.
Dickinson used that little phrase, called back, in the last letter she ever wrote, a letter to her cousins to tell them she was dying. It read, in its entirety, Little Cousins, called back, Emily. Again, she was concise. But if you're called back, there must be a caller, which might be why death seems so comforting in a lot of her poems. Joseph Lees.
I think one of the ways that Because I Could Not Stop for Death really speaks to contemporary readers, I think when the dead speak in a poem, when a posthumous voice speaks, it answers one of our deepest needs. We hope that there's a heaven, and not just a heaven, but a heaven where you're still yourself, where there's still a sense of personal agency.
Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me.
About 14 years ago, Emily Dickinson came back to life on late-night radio in Boston. A woman named Belinda West portrayed her a few times on WGBH's Night Air, and she's still playing Dickinson at schools and various events. I thought talking to her might be the closest I could get to talking to the poet herself. Except, what do you ask Emily Dickinson?
Were you lonely?
Sir, we've hardly met. Are you lonely?
You never feel quite so small as when Emily Dickinson gives you a hard time.
And why don't you seek to publish more?
Oh, fame is a bee. It has a song, it has a sting, and too, it has a wing.
That's a whole Dickinson poem, actually, just those four lines.
This business of submitting material to those who only change its form entirely and its meaning as well, why seek that? It's the auction of the mind.
And Belinda's citing another poem there. The full quote is, "Publication is the auction of the mind of man." Dickinson published 11 poems while she was alive, all of them anonymously. No one saw Because I Could Not Stop for Death until it was put out in a volume of her work, 4 years after her actual death. And even then, no one saw the whole poem. The editors on that first posthumous collection cut out the fourth stanza.
"We passed the setting sun. Or rather, he passed us. The dews drew quivering and chill for only gossamer my gown, my tippet only tulle."
This is a total mystery. My best guess is that they thought Dickinson was too scantily clad in her gown of gossamer. Anyway, it wasn't until 1955 that the full version of the poem was published. And over the years, certain poets have gotten pretty excited about that gown of gossamer part, if you know what I mean.
I was taking my clue from that stanza.
This is Billy Collins again. He's talking about the title poem of one of his books. It's called Taking Off Emily Dickinson's Clothes.
I've removed her tippet, of course, and then the gown of gossamer. That's got to go.
Is she naked at the end of this poem?
She's naked in the second stanza, yeah.
Collins wrote the poem, he says, because he was tired of this one particular thread in Dickinsonian scholarship, the question of her sexuality, whether she was gay or not. He calls it unprofitable gossip.
And that was the frustration I experienced when I decided to write Taking Off Emily Dickinson's Clothes and have sex with her.
So you have sex with her in the poem?
Yes.
You dog, you.
Well, little grr. Rough.
Collins' poem is one of about 80, collected in a whole anthology of tributes to Dickinson. Her influence is renewed with every generation of writers. Again, Joseph Lees.
The gorgeous music and amazing rhythmical control in her work are there in a number of contemporary poets, and that's something that inspires me deeply. I feel like I tune my ear by reading her poetry aloud, and you know, along with other poets as well, of course, but always her, always returning to her.
"Stop for death, he kindly stopped for me."
And musicians keep returning to her, too. This poem has been scored at least 5 times, including this version by Aaron Copland and 3 folk versions.
"We slowly drove in, you know, haste, and I had put away
my labor and my leisure too for his civility."
In fact, the poem is so iconic it's been spoofed in newspaper columns. The one in the Denver Rocky Mountain News turned it into a story about a skiing accident.
"Because I could not stop for breath, it kindly stopped for me. We'd both been going awfully fast until I hit a tree."
Maybe this is why Dickinson rejected the very idea of fame, at least while she was around to experience it. One time, in a letter to a friend who was critical of her work, Dickinson wrote, "I smile when you suggest that I delay to publish, that being foreign to my thought as firmament to fin. If fame belonged to me, I could not escape her." For Studio 360, I'm Sean Cole.
You can find out more about Emily Dickinson and all the American icons in our series, from The Great Gatsby to the Lincoln Memorial to Barbie, at studio360.org. And while you're there, sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter. I'm Kurt Anderson. Thanks very much for listening. I hope you'll join us again next week. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Medinowski,
Sarah Lilly,
Rob Weisberg,
Catherine Epstein,
Jill Duboff.
And our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
PRI's Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, by the Lilly Auchincloss Foundation, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Studio 360's American Icons Project is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Great ideas brought to life.
PRI, Public Radio International.
As the world's largest particle accelerator ever starts to rev up, scientists couldn't be more excited. But a few people think the end of the world is nigh.
There's an entirely different world beyond that black hole.
Writer Lydia Millett wonders what it would be like to have our own black hole right here on Earth.
He was reminded of children at zoos. It was the end of the world show, the apocalypse in a jar.
Next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.